This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.net, where you can listen to live shows in our past or past shows in our iPod Ready archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. Now, if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via the satellite. Just go to the website for details. Tonight we have a wonderfully interesting and fascinating guest, Alan Brown. Alan wrote the book, among many books, but this one is the one we're basically going to be discussing tonight, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a book that exposes many obscure facts about our money system, about our economic past and future, where our money is going and why it went there. And she also offers a lot of suggestions as to how to get it back. Hello, Helen. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you for being with us tonight. It's really a pleasure having you. You're just, like I said, your books are just unbelievably fascinating. You were the last time we discussed a lot of the issues in forbidden medicine and some of the other books. Ellen, let me ask you. First of all, I understand The Web of Debt has gone into its third edition.
Yes, things keep changing. It was self-published, and I managed to get it out 2 weeks after that first collapse of the Bear Stearns hedge funds in July of 2007. Mm-hmm. And then as the facts changed, I added some addendums and modified a few things. So it's not hugely different, but yeah, it's up to date.
Well, that's wonderful. Congratulations. I mean, anything these days is quite an accomplishment, but a third edition is wonderful. Ellen, you knew this was all going to happen as far as the economy and what's been happening in the news the last 6 months.
Yes. Last fall, I wrote about that the real crisis was not being discussed. It wasn't really the foreclosure issue, which was what it was being blamed on, people buying properties they couldn't afford. It was really the derivatives. And it's very complicated. I don't know if you want to go into that. But there was much going on behind the scenes that we weren't being told about. And even now, we're not really being told, I think. In the latest article I wrote was on the Bank for International Settlements, which is in Basel, Switzerland, and it is really the controlling mechanism for the whole banking system worldwide, the private central banking system. And they actually, by some authorities, have been credited with causing the credit freeze, and they did the same thing to Japan in the 1990s. Japan had the biggest banks in the world at that time, and they were the world's biggest creditors. And the Basel I accords were imposed, which was a rule, an accounting rule that required them to have more capital than they actually had. And there was an immediate credit freeze in Japan, and the banks started going bankrupt, and they've never recovered from that. So the same thing happened to us in the fall of 2007. In October of 2007, our stock market hit its all-time high. It passed 14,000, the Dow. Mm. And in November, the month right after that, the credit freeze started, and we've never recovered from it since. And that was when the Basel II Accords were adopted by our Office of OCC, the Controller of the Currency. And the mark-to-market rule was imposed by our Financial Accounting Standards Board, which sets the accounting rules for the private banking system in the U.S.
And now, you know, Ellen, I've talked to a couple of people in the investment field, and they seem to believe that actually in 2007, during that period of time, it was actually worse than today.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, financially, fiscally and financially, we were worse off at that point than we are today. Do you believe that to be true?
Well, we wound up bailing out these banks in the fall of last year. That was 2008, and that was supposedly because Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. Well, first there was the Bear Stearns bankruptcy in March, and then in the summer there was Fannie and Freddie and the AIG, and then Lehman Brothers was allowed to just collapse totally, and it was heavily there was short selling going on heavily. So it was that collapse was manipulated. I mean, it was Lehman Brothers was pushed into bankruptcy, and it was allowed to collapse in a way that there was a panic among the money market funds, and they, according to Henry Paulson, this is what he went to Congress with. He told them that there had been a $550 billion run on the money market funds within the space of 2 hours on that day, September 15th. And it was just a bloodletting of money being pulled out of the banks. And that had they let that go on, that we would have had a total collapse of our credit system. And that's the reason Congress agreed to this bailout, although everybody knew we were bailing out the crooks, and we still know that. But we have been made to believe that we have no choice, because if we let any of these big derivatives banks go bankrupt, we will bankrupt the system and we'll have no credit system. But so that's where the illusion is. First of all, they didn't need to let Lehman Brothers go bankrupt in that way. They could have done an orderly bankruptcy like they did with IndyMac and taken care of the money market funds that had given them to someone, to other bank or whatever. But besides that, they've made us think that our only choice is this huge, failing, zombie Wall Street banking system, when in fact we could set up our own banks, and that's what I think the solution is. Every state could set up its own bank that operates in the same way that the private banks do. One state in the country has its own bank, that's North Dakota. They are one of the only four states that are actually solvent, meaning they actually can meet their budget. In fact, they have a $1.2 billion surplus, and they have plenty of money for everything they need. They have money for, they give 1% loans to farmers. They rarely do foreclosures. These are new farmers. They have a lot of money for student loans. They have one of the best student loan programs in the country, and the reason is that they have their own credit mechanism, and they've had it ever since 1919, when they were tired of foreclosures being imposed from outside. The Wall Street bankers, their money was going to Wall Street and the railroad men and the granaries, so they had no control over this, where the farmers were losing their farms. And so they got together and they passed legislation that where all the state's revenues would go into one bank, this Bank of North Dakota, and then that bank can do what any bank does. It creates credit on its books up to 10 times the amount of money it has in deposit. So that's what I think.
Let me ask you, Helen. So you believe that the central banks having the ability to loan to government is a better system? In other words, are you talking about nationalism and nationalizing, like, say, the Federal Reserve, too?
The Federal Reserve is called federal. Everybody thinks it is federal. It should be federal, yes. That would be a first step, is make it what people think it is. And what actually, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, the opposition said absolutely not. They would not pass any bill that gave the power to create the nation's money supply to private bankers, and that was when it was called the Aldrich Bill. And then the Wall Street group bringing the bill changed the name and made the opposition, which was led by William Jennings Bryan, believe that what they were getting was federally issued money, and that's how they got the bill passed. So it's been an illusion or a fraud all along. So we might as well make it what people think it is, which everybody thinks the government issues the money. The government should issue the money. The Federal Reserve should be federal. Banks should only lend other people's money or their own money, but not create money on their books. That's what people think the system is. So you wouldn't have to nationalize every bank, but when a big Wall Street, too big to fail bank goes bankrupt, instead of bailing them out with government money, which means taxpayer money, we can put them through bankruptcy in the ordinary way. The FDIC comes in and poses a receiver. That's what's supposed to be done. And then they do nationalize it. I mean, that's one of the remedies of the FDIC. It's been done before. It's not. There's nothing unusual about it. That's one of the alternatives they have, is to take over the bankrupt entity. So it's not like it is too big to fail. In other words, you're not just letting it collapse and disappear. You're allowing it to function, but you're putting in a public receiver who is now taking it over. And that's called, I mean, if you want to use the word nationalization, fine, but what you're doing is putting in a public receiver to sort things out. So
well,
those banks,
yes,
they should be nationalized.
Well, let me ask you. Well, obviously you're helping us to understand some of the mechanisms that were in place for them for taking over the systems. How do they make money when they collapse a bank, or when they collapse some of the systems that have been collapsing around us lately? How do they make money that way?
What do you mean by they?
Well,
the
banks that are still surviving. Someone's making money. I mean, obviously, we know that the rich are getting richer.
Well,
and
we know the JP Morgan
and it isn't the American people.
No, for sure. They are. It is said that JP Morgan has to eat other banks periodically because they have this huge derivatives book. Well, that's a very complicated subject. But anyway, JP Morgan is getting bigger and bigger. They don't.
Yeah.
They took over Washington Mutual, for example, which was a huge bank. So they are obviously profiting. JP Morgan got $55 billion out of the takeover of Bear Stearns. They bought it for pennies on the dollar, and they got the money from us, the government. We gave a $30 billion loan directly to them and another $25 billion to Bear Stearns. So they made out like bandits, you could say. And interestingly, the head of JP Morgan, the CEO, is Jamie Dimon. He sits on the board of the New York Federal Reserve, which made that decision. You would normally call that insider trading, illegal conflict of interest, but there's nobody, and there is such a rule. I mean, that is illegal, and theoretically you could go to jail for that, but there's nobody around to prosecute because they're just too powerful.
Well, powerfully corrupt, I would imagine. I mean, if this is illegal, it's illegal, and this is something that I've always argued, keyword illegal, and why is our government allowing this to continue is just an amazing situation in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get it back? How do we get our power back, Ellen?
Well, there's the Ron Paul group that is attempting to have the Fed audited and then abolished. That's one approach, but I don't know that it's such a direct approach that it seems to me that it's not likely to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I like the idea of setting up a state bank. It's totally legal. There's nothing unless there's state legislation against it, but it's not unconstitutional. It's been done. There's a model out there in North Dakota. They've had theirs for 90 years. And it's just anybody can set up a bank, you know, if you pass the requirements of the banking commissioners. So a state could easily, if they made up their mind to do it, take their revenues, put it in a form a new bank, and then create credit on their books. I think the problem is that most people don't understand how banking works. I went to the state Democratic convention recently, and we talked to different people, and they're pretty much clueless. You have to get over that initial hurdle of understanding how banking works, and that's where the whole illusion has been all this time, and that's where the problem is. The problem is that all our money comes from banks as loans. The banks are always take out more than they put in. I mean, always take back more than they put out. In other words, they lend 10, take back 10 and a half, lend 10 and a half, take back 11 and a quarter or something, whatever it works out to. So, and since banks are the only source of money in the system, which is something that most people don't understand, but that's a fact, then somebody somewhere has to be taking out a new loan to create the money to service the old loan. So it's a Ponzi scheme, and we're at the end of that Ponzi scheme. That system can no longer survive. So we have to set up another system. And that's what I think, instead of going head-to-head with the old system and saying, we're going to change the system and pass all this legislation and stuff, what the better solution is to merely quietly set up something that works better, which would be some public banking institutions. In India, they have public banks right alongside private banks, and right now everybody's fleeing to the public banks because they're more secure.
Well, we have a lot of questions coming in from our listeners. Ellen, usually it doesn't happen so quickly. Do you mind if I interject with some of them?
No, that's fine.
I guess everybody's really concerned about what's happening in the economy today. Well, the first question is from John from the Canadian Rockies, and he asks, Ellen, what role might credit unions play in providing a remedy to the ills of the banking system?
Well, today, credit unions, as I understand it, operate just like regular banks. So they're not much different, except for the fact that they tend to be local, and therefore they haven't gotten into all this derivatives mess. So they are a safer bet. And I'm fully in favor of going local anywhere you can. But really,
so you think that's definitely a better idea. But you're saying that if it acts exactly the same as the bank, they're not basing it on derivatives, what are they basing it on?
Well, the derivatives were a power play of those big Wall Street banks. Right now, last fall there were $180 trillion in derivatives on the books of U.S. banks, and $89 trillion were on the books of J.P. Morgan, $38 trillion Citigroup, and $38 trillion Bank of America. So that was practically all of them right there. There's just five big banks that have almost all of them. So it's a Wall Street problem. It's not a local problem. The local banks didn't mess with that. So that's why they've escaped that particular thing. But the local banks are struggling because it's all one banking system. And the way banks operate, they only check to make sure they have enough reserves to meet the requirement every 2 weeks. And if they don't, what they do is they borrow from other banks. You know, it's the overnight thing. And if the other banks aren't lending, then they're in trouble. So that's why now the other banks aren't lending, at least up until recently they weren't. So everybody's nervous. They don't want to make loans even that before would have looked like perfectly
good
solid
loans
because they just don't want to have too many loans out there.
Right.
So everything is kind of contracting because of
the problem. Well, is anybody giving loans out there at all? Is there any place in the country that's giving loans right now?
Yes. Well, the banks are arguing that it's not their fault that they actually are pretty much loaned up. The problem is the shadow lenders went away. It used to be that banks are allowed to lend. Well, with the capital requirement, it's an 8% capital requirement. So if you had $8 in capital, you could make $100 in loans. But what they would do is make these $100 in loans, and then they sold them off to investors. And that's where the derivatives came in, because they wrapped them in a derivative, meaning they sold off the risk to some other set of investors in order to get the investors to buy. And now those things have been shown to be a sham. And so all those investors have gone away. You're not going to get the Chinese and the Europeans to buy our collateralized debt obligations anymore. So once the bank has, with its $8 of capital, once it's made $100 in loans, that's as far as it can go. So you've cut out half the lending market just by taking the shadow lenders away. I think they had 40% of the market, actually.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Fred in Canada wants you to answer. There are many rumors of the U.S. dollar collapsing. What is your opinion on this event and its effects on the U.S. debt and the economy?
I don't think the dollar will collapse because other currencies collapse because they are manipulated in the currency markets. And our debts are in dollars. So we can always meet our, we're not going to go bankrupt. We're not going to say we can't afford to pay. All we have to do is print the dollars and pay. What the concern is that if we did that, we would hyperinflate the dollar. But when Germany, in the Weimar hyperinflation, they only printed 50%. They did print money to meet their budget, but it was only, they only covered 50% of their budget that way. In other words, they didn't print all that much. And England is already engaged in what's called seigniorage or quantitative easing. They're already printing that much of their budget. And the pound hasn't collapsed. It was something else that collapsed the German mark. The mark went to 1/1,000,000,000th of its former value. And what it was speculation in the foreign exchange markets. The speculators came in and they were madly selling the mark short because everybody knew that Germany couldn't afford to pay its war debts. And so there was this huge demand for marks, and the banks were happily supplying the marks so that they could sell short. You know, you have to cover your short sale by having the marks lined up to buy them back at the lower price. So,
well,
so the banks were
considering we have such an exorbitant war debt since Iraq. Aren't we facing a similar situation? I mean, we've never had a debt like this before.
Right, but Germany had to pay its debts in other currencies. They couldn't just print their marks and pay off their debts. They could print marks and buy the other currencies on the foreign exchange market, and that's where the manipulation comes in, because that's like what happened in Zimbabwe. They had to pay off their debts, and so they were printing Zimbabwe local currency and buying U.S. dollars with it. Well, the speculators could see what was going on, so they just kept raising the price of the dollars, and the price of the Zimbabwe currency collapsed. But they can't do that to us, because when our bonds come due, we always pay them off. All you do is you print some dollars and pay it off. And what we normally do is we get the dollars by selling new bonds. So we just keep rolling over the bonds.
Let me ask what's backing our dollars that we're printing? I mean, I know somebody is in the back room somewhere with a computer and typing in numbers, and suddenly they manifest into dollars. But that one time we had the gold standard that was backing our dollars, our monetary system, the greenbacks, and now we don't. So what's backing them now?
Mm-hmm. Nothing. The full faith and credit of the United States. And that's the reason, to my mind, the system should be a public system. Really, all the dollar is a legal agreement. And the proper party for overseeing this agreement, all credit is advancing or an agreement to accept payment over time instead of immediately. And the proper party to oversee that is really the judiciary or a branch of the judiciary. In other words, it's contracts between parties. And what you want to know is that the party on the other side is going to perform. So you want some agency that will, that's why you go to your bank. You don't trust this stranger who walks into town to pay you over time because you don't know him. But the two parties will trust this bank that's been around for a long time, and the bank says, all right, we'll pretend that we have the money, we'll create the credit on our books, and we'll pay off the seller, and then you'll pay us back over time, and you'll pay us double for taking the risk that maybe you won't pay us back. But that's where they've gotten into trouble, because it's a huge illusion or fraud, and they're always juggling these balls because they don't really have the money. But if it were that the government itself issuing the full faith and credit of the United States, or in other words, just a legal department checking to make sure that everybody's playing fair here and paying back when they said they would, then you don't have to worry about shortage of money, because you're not really talking about money. You're talking about agreements.
You're talking about it. Well, then let me ask you this. For instance, China. We owe them tremendous amounts of money. I don't even remember how much it is right now. And are they satisfied with the fact that, considering their industrial growth over the last couple of decades, are they really that invested in trusting the United States
to pay them back with dollars that are no more than a contractual agreement?
Well, that's what we've already paid them in dollars. We bought their products, and their merchants had a lot of dollars. So the Chinese Central Bank printed up the local currency, renminbi, and bought up the dollars. So there was printing presses running here anyway. They print their own currency, buy up the dollars, and then they use the dollars to buy our bonds, and we pay them interest basically to keep those dollars off the market. So here we have this drain of interest going out all the time to foreigners so that they won't reinvest their dollars in the U.S. But right now we have a big deflation going on. We want their dollars. We're begging for customers. So it would actually be good for the U.S. if they decide to not roll over their bonds. And in fact, I think the U.S. should say that what we should do is pay off the bonds as they come due and then say, we're no longer selling bonds to foreigners. We're now going to monetize our debt with our own central bank. The advantage of that is the Federal Reserve rebates the interest to the government after it deducts its cost. So it's the best deal in town for the U.S. government. If they walk over to the Federal Reserve, they can fund their debt for under 0.5% interest.
But is that advantageous to foreign investors?
Well, they are actually talking about buying less debt than before, and that's one reason that our Fed has been buying long-term government bonds. I was in Malaysia recently, and that former prime minister who sponsored the conference I was at said, I think we have far too many dollars. I think we should spend some of those dollars on tractors and bulldozers and things that we could use for infrastructure development. Well, that's the thing. If they would come here and we can put limits on what they're going to spend these dollars on, but we did spend them in their country, and we want trade going on. We want them to come back and buy some of our products. We want somebody to buy our products. There must be something we could make if there was a market for it, like bulldozers and tractors.
Well, there's a definite market for bulldozers. Ask the Palestinians.
Well, that is a problem. Those are specially adapted. I know I used to own Caterpillar stock, and when I found that out, I had to sell it.
Good for you. You're my kind of gal. I happen to be Palestinian. So,
oh, really?
That means a whole lot. Rachel,
but I'm looking
Idaho.
For another tractor company.
Oh, okay.
Maybe John Deere.
So,
I don't know who
else. Like the idea of investing in tractors.
It would be a good time to buy tractors, not necessarily.
Well,
tractors.
There you go, folks. Alan Brown is investing in tractors. Now, just find the right company.
Well, China is heavily invested in infrastructure development right now. That's what they're doing. Instead of putting so much money into foreign trade, which they recognize is a mistake, and that's why they they're not really in trouble. They're doing better than everybody else. But that's where the drain is on the economy. It's the same in Malaysia. That's what they're recognizing as the problem, too much foreign trade or too much dependence on foreign customers. So in China, what they're doing now is they have these four development banks that are mostly state-owned. They're like 80% state-owned. And they are madly making loans. I mean, they don't have any credit problem within their country because they are making loans to build stuff inside the country in order to increase production. I read that they were doing things like building roads to nowhere because the idea is, I mean, they're building roads to these remote farms because the idea is once there's a road there, the people at the end of the road will start
coming back
making things they can sell to the city. Yeah, that it will encourage trade by opening up the veins, you know, or the arteries to trade.
Well, which
we
brings
did that
me
when we,
to... Which brings me to an interesting question about our own economy here in the United States. We have been successfully, brilliantly, outsourcing a majority of our manufacturing to the detriment of our own economy. Why are we doing that, Ellen? I mean, if other countries are doing and knowing, are realizing that this very issue would degrade their economy. We don't know that? Of course we know that. Why are we doing it?
Well, there's all this emphasis on short-term profits. The way our whole stock market thing is set up, everybody has to report quarterly, and if they miss their estimates in mere fraction of percentage points, then the stock plummets and everybody worries about losing money. So they're not thinking long term. The planning is not good just because of the nature of our profit oriented system. But yeah.
Well, Rachel in Idaho asked this question, so let me put it in, stick it in here because I think it's relevant to the question. How do you rate Obama and his economic solutions? And this with the stimulus packages and stuff like that. Is there anything in there that's long term, or are we just doing another quick fix, like we wanted to have everything immediately and no long term plans prior to this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm of a mixed mind. I think he totally means well, and I think he's probably totally tied. I read that Clinton said when he got into the presidency, he said, gee, I thought when I got to be president, I'd be making the decisions. They pretty much have to cater to that whole banking entity and the big corporations. So there's an attempt to do the right thing, but whether they can pull it, I mean, not much of concrete achievement has happened yet.
No.
The one positive thing I saw in the banking thing was that Ben Bernanke said that they were going to buy $300 billion in long-term government bonds. Well, everybody thinks that's terrible because it would be hyperinflationary, but I think it's a good thing. And the reason is, as I say, we get bonds from the Fed at 0.5% interest. It's the cheapest way we can fund the debt. If you're funding it with the Chinese, you're going to be paying them 3 or 4% interest, and you have this debt to a foreign power. If you're going through your own Federal Reserve, which is giving you the money almost interest-free, and they'll roll it over indefinitely, it's almost the same as creating the money. You don't have to hit up the taxpayers, and you don't have to go further into debt to foreigners or to anybody outside the system.
And so there are solutions.
Yeah, so that was a good thing. But then the Ben Bernanke said that they were doing $700 billion for other things, providing loans for businesses. That's all good. All the commercial stuff that they're doing is good. But a lot of that money is going to the banks themselves to clean up their books. And that is, I think that's courting disaster because they're just pouring money down the black hole of these derivatives gambles that are on the books of the banks. For instance, that money we paid to AIG, one of the blatant examples was, I believe it was $12 billion that went to Goldman Sachs to pay off their credit default swaps, which are sheer, utter derivative gambling. I mean, we're just paying the gambling debts of other banks. We're allowing other banks to win on these bets that they shouldn't have won on. It was one thing to stand behind Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because there was this implied guarantee when the Chinese, for instance, bought those bonds. They were supposed to be as good as government bonds. So there was some logic to that. But to stand behind the credit default swaps sold by AIG to another big bank first of all, it can't work because there are too many derivatives out there. We can't possibly pay off $180 trillion in derivatives. But second of all, we're rewarding the people who should not be rewarded at our expense.
That's amazing. You know, we're going to take a break right now, Ellen. There's so many more questions. It's like, you know... Well, we'll just have to come back and talk more about it because there's a million more questions that I have to ask you. We'll be back with Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, and just a fascinating guest. Thank you very much, Ellen, for being with us, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, folks.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in The Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed. Starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax, as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Join the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, an international three-month event spanning seven continents and over 1 million participants, with endorsements from luminaries worldwide such as President Jimmy Carter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The World March for Peace and Nonviolence seeks to bring attention to the need to end war and occupation, reduce arms spending, and all forms of violence. Please visit theworldmarch.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea.
Hello, everybody. We're back with Ellen Brown, the author of The Web of Debt and many other books. Ellen, in about 14 books, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ellen. I'm
11.
Sorry if I missed one. How many?
11, actually.
11. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I read 14 somewhere. I'm mistaken. Well, if you wrote 11, you can write 14, I'm sure.
But I have three more in my head. Yeah.
Oh, great. See? Now, there you go. Ellen, you know, we were talking in, on break, and you were going to help everyone to understand how money is created. I think that's mm-hmm. important so people can understand the concepts that you're discussing.
I think that's important for understanding what went wrong and what we can do about it. Because if you think that the banks just have the money and we need to get the money and therefore we're forced to borrow from them, then you don't see a way out. But when you realize that the banks themselves do not have the money, and that's the reason that they're in trouble, and that's the reason a public banking system would work much better. I mean, there is another type of system we could set up. We really have to start over because this one is at the end of the line and it can't be saved. So here is how money is created. There have been two competitive money systems for the last 300 years, ever since we have dealt with paper money. The one that we have now is privately issued, banker-created money. And it was the central bank system was started in England in 1694. Well, it was actually went back to Sweden, but England was the one that wound up controlling. That was when the Bank of England was founded. Before that, there were goldsmiths in England, goldsmiths and silversmiths, who would keep people's heavy precious metals for safekeeping, and they would issue these little paper receipts called banknotes. And they discovered that people only came for their notes 10% of the time on average. So they could safely lend up to 10 times as many notes as they actually had gold and silver in their vaults. So that was the beginning of what's called fractional reserve banking, where 90% of their notes were essentially counterfeited. There was nothing backing them. And that is the system we still have today, even though we're no longer on the gold standard. But the other system was created by the American system by Henry Clay, who was a senator in the 19th century. He distinguished it from the British system, which was the banker-created money. In the American system, the money was created by the community or by the local government. So the colonies all issued their own paper scrip, and they did that because they just didn't have the gold and silver that was the preferred source of money. So it started with the governor of Massachusetts, who needed some money to fund a war in 1691, and he didn't have any money, so he just printed these paper receipts to pay the soldiers and the suppliers. They were basically just acknowledging that service had been rendered to the community and that they were therefore entitled to go out and pay, spend that sum of labor or whatever, that sum of value on products available in the community. So those notes then traded as money, and they were a permanent source of money. Once they were out there, they were legal tender, and they kept trading. So you didn't have to worry about this debt and had to be paid back with the extra, et cetera. There's not a lot of scrambling where you had to always have growth and expansion like we do now, because you have to always find the money to pay the interest to keep the whole debt system going.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that for 100 years, but we actually lost it after the Revolution. That was when, it's complicated how we lost it. People thought that the Continental, which was the paper money used to actually fund the whole Revolutionary War, which is amazing in itself, that we could win a war just by issuing paper receipts. We didn't have the gold and silver to fund the thing. But the Continental collapsed during the Revolution, and everybody thought that was because the government had issued too many of them, and then they were afraid of paper money. But in fact, it collapsed because at that time, paper money was easily counterfeited, and the British were sitting in the harbor with printing presses, madly printing this stuff and giving it to anyone who would take it. And so they were diluting the money supply, which brought down its value. Plus, the money had to compete with more stable currencies, just like in the same way that the Zimbabwe currency collapsed. If you are a currency trader, or if your currency is competing with gold, anybody would take gold over this paper currency of an army that might lose. And they mm-hmm. would even take the paper money of the states over this risky paper money of an army. So by the end of the war, it had lost its value, and the Continental Congress was afraid to even put it in the Constitution that Congress had the power to issue money, issue paper money. So all they said was Congress shall have the power to coin money. And that's all Congress does, is create coins, which are 1/10,000th of the money supply. That's the mint, of course, but it's a government entity. And all of the rest is now created privately by banks. Well, Alexander Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary, and he inherited this huge war debt, and he didn't have any money to pay it off. So he did... really, he's been blamed for this, but he did what he had to do, which was set up the same ruse that was used in England, where the gold that the government did have was put into this one bank, privately owned bank, and then the bank issued paper receipts, supposedly backed by gold, but in that way they were able to issue 10 times as many receipts as they had gold. So suddenly they had the money to pay off their debts, and everybody accepted this paper because they knew that they were allowed to walk in the bank and trade it in for gold if they wanted to. But they didn't want to because nobody wanted to carry this risky and heavy gold around. Yeah.
Which was called the gold standard. And a lot of people believe that the gold standard it was the most pristine of all economic systems. You had gold that backed each dollar that was put out there.
Well, actually, gold was the reason that we got into this whole fraudulent system, because it looked like the money was backed by gold, but it wasn't. It was a shell game. They just had enough gold for the people who came and asked for it. And all the other people, that's why they had runs on the bank all through the 19th century. And when the banks did not, because periodically people would realize or get suspicious, and they would all come and ask for their gold at once, and then the bank would have to admit they didn't have it, and they would close their doors. And then you would have a depression when there was a wave of these runs. And then the banks would have to call in their loans because they didn't. They had too many loans outstanding for the money they had. And then, so that meant they wound up foreclosing on the farms. So it was actually the end of our personal sovereignty. You know, we were, the way we were founded, you could go out and homestead a plot of land, and you owned that free and clear. You could grow some grains, and you had your pigs and goats and cows and chickens, and that was and your own well, and that was really all you needed. You were self-sufficient. But then the farmers started, even though they owned the thing free and clear, they would take out a mortgage on their farms to buy something, I suppose tractors, when tractors came in. But before that, just the things that you couldn't produce on the farm. And then when the banks would periodically have these depressions and contractions of the money supply, the loans would get called, or for different reasons, people would, the whole economy would contract like it is right now, and then there wouldn't be employment, and then, you know, it's the same reasons we have now. So people would go into foreclosure, and they lost their farms. And now, of course, it's very hard to make it as a small farmer if you're not one of those great big agribusiness farms.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really compete in the market. So now the American dream was supposedly to own your own home, but what that means is owning a condo somewhere in the city, that you still don't have your own land and your own well. I mean, you're still totally dependent on the system. So we lost our independence because of this banking system where they could, it was unreliable. The money you were borrowing might get called before you were able to pay it back.
Right. Now, and then what happened after the gold system?
Yeah, well, then in 1913, there was a huge, 1907, there was a huge bank panic where there was runs on banks. And so J.P. Morgan nobly stepped in and with money they'd gotten from Europe, supposedly from the Rothschilds, of whom it was thought he was an agent. And there was evidence that he actually started the panic for this purpose. And that's what I'm saying. I think there's evidence that the Bank for International Settlements started the current panic because they want to take over that same sort of power globally. But anyway, what J.P. Morgan did was he stepped in, and then he and his committee of Wall Street bankers drafted this legislation that would set up a central bank that would backstop bank runs. So this central bank would have the ability to print money, the national currency, Federal Reserve notes, and could then provide the reserves for the banks so that they, at that time the reserves were gold, you know, they could provide enough gold so that the banks, if there was a run, they could get it from somewhere else. And so they could keep up the shell game longer because they had spread it around more. But that didn't work. In 1933, we still had the biggest bank run that in history. And at that point, people didn't trust the banks at all. And so they were all rushing in with their paper money and taking the gold out. Well, at that point, the paper money was 40% backed by gold. So that meant every time somebody brought in $2 and got their gold, $3 in loans had to be recalled. So again, there was this drastic shrinking of the money supplies because the whole money supply was a fraud. It was all based on this pretend gold backing that wasn't there, and if the backing wasn't there, then the loans had to be called in. We had a huge depression in it, and it all collapsed. So that's why Roosevelt, he took the dollar off the gold standard. He really did what he had to do. It wasn't going to work the other way. We didn't have any money in the system. And when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard internationally in 1971, it was for the same reason, because the French, De Gaulle cashed in all his dollars for gold. He didn't trust us to have the gold because of the Vietnam War. We were heavily in debt then. And then the British tried to do the same thing, and Nixon said, sorry, we just didn't have that much gold. It was going to clean us out. And So that's when currencies started to float internationally. But the whole current, where we still, 10% in deposits is supposed to be sufficient to fund, like $10 in deposits will fund $100 in loans. That all goes back to the discovery of the goldsmiths, the people only came for their gold 10% of the time. I mean, it was a fraud. It was a ruse.
Well, let me ask you then. All right, understandably, that's fine. But look at how the gold prices have been unbelievably inflated and exaggerated over the last year or so. And what of the existing gold? What is it actually being used for? Well, look at Fort Knox. We have a system that, that is no longer based on a gold system, a gold monetary system. And we've got a lot of gold. So is the gold worthless, or is it backing something else?
Nobody's sure there's really anything in Fort Knox because it hasn't been audited since the 1950s under Eisenhower.
You're kidding.
No.
No.
I mean, they do an internal audit, but do we trust them? Nobody from the outside has been allowed in to look and see what's there. So it is thought by... I am a gold investor myself, even though I don't think it would work as a currency. I do think it's a good long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
And it is thought by us gold bugs that they were using that gold to manipulate the market. You know, they manipulate every market. That's why there's no... People ask me, what's a good, reliable investment? And I don't know, because everything is manipulated. If you were an insider, it would be very easy to say what the next hot investment would be.
Easy
dollars.
But illegal.
Sorry? Yeah.
Easy but illegal.
Yeah. Well, the bank stocks are up now for no good reason. That was manipulated, if you ask me. And the market is looking better, but do you trust that, or is that manipulated? Who knows? There's clear evidence of manipulation, for instance, last July when the dollar was plunging, the bank stocks were plunging, and Fannie and Freddie were about to go bankrupt, and all of a sudden the dollar turned around and the other currencies went down relative to it. I know, mm-hmm. because I foolishly bought the other currencies right then. And gold had gone over $1,000 an ounce, and oil was up to $140 an ounce. I mean, they were all topping out, and then all of a sudden those things just crashed and the dollar shot up. For no reason. There was no reason why the dollar should have strengthened. And it was revealed by the head of the central bank in the Bank of Japan that the central bankers had gotten together and they had been told to buy dollars, and they had all bought dollars. So they propped up the dollar, in other words. It used to be they called that a monopoly and, you know, illegal, an antitrust violation and collusion, but now it's all considered something for stability and something that's good for the system. Well, it's good for the big players, but there are a lot of little people who don't know that that's coming, who do the reasonable thing, which is sell dollars or buy gold, and then all of a sudden that stuff just turns around for no reason.
You know, it almost seems like a big fairy story, Ellen, the way you're talking about it. That nothing that we have is really based on anything substantial or real.
Right.
We'd be surprised as Americans if people didn't trust us.
Yeah. Well, everybody around the world has been locked into this system now. The Bank for International Settlement is composed of 55 countries. That all have central banks that belong to this system. So in most places, it's bank-created money, privately issued money, and it's controlled centrally by foreigners. It's a private thing that we have no political control over it.
Well, we have a question from one of our guests, but before we answer, let me ask. If these foreign countries have the central bank, eventually won't they, in effect, do better than the United States is going to do?
sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that, you know, here you talked about Malaysia and a couple of the other places. Because of the fact that they have a central bank, they, in effect, are actually doing a little bit better. And in the future, will that not make them better off than the people in the United States, the economy in the United States, due to the fact that they have a central bank and we don't?
We do have, well, most central banks are privately owned, and including ours. The Bank of England is technically publicly owned, but in fact, there's a holding company. It's very obscure, and I was trying to track that down, and I can't really see what's happening, but it's operated just like a private bank. It's operated for the benefit of the bankers. In Malaysia is one of the few places where the central bank actually is owned by the government, and Malaysia is doing really well, except for this problem that they have with foreign trade, that they're losing their foreign customers like everybody is. When I was on the plane, I was sitting next to a businessman, and I mentioned about that I'd been invited by the former prime minister, and he said, "Oh, you know, he's that people are suspicious of him. He had built this whole second capital city, and nobody knew where he got the money for it." Well, it turned out, as I learned when I got there, I saw this capital city. It looked like Disneyland. It's gorgeous. It's very modern. It's a totally different place from the Philippines, which is right next door. And what they did was they used their power to issue money, and they just printed the money and built the thing, put people to work, which is, so it's infrastructure development. And but they don't talk about it a lot. So actually, they stood up to the international bankers in 1998, and that's why they've survived. Everybody else in the Asian crisis, their currencies were brought down because they agreed to let their currencies float and they let the speculators in. But Malaysia didn't allow speculation in their currency, and they didn't let.
So they ended up doing a lot better than the rest.
Yeah, and China too.
Absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
And China did the same thing. They did not get sucked into the Asian crisis because they did not let their currency float. And so the speculators couldn't bring it down. Of course, they're so big anyway that it would be hard for speculators to bring down that.
Exactly. Well, this has just been wonderful, Ellen. Unfortunately, we're at the end of our hour. Anytime we talk to you, it's just like, you know, you're just such a wealth of information. You really are, and I felt like I was just having a personal conversation with you, and I thank you again for being with us. That's The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown. She also has a blog. Ellen, what is the website to your blog?
It's at webofdebt.com is my website, and then the blog is a link at the top.
And there you go, folks. If you have questions, I think that that's really a great place for you to go. Our guest next week is going to be the sister of Leonard Peltier, Betty Peltier, and Leonard has been in prison illegally for over 30 years. It's going to be a great evening, and I hope all of you will join us. A very important interview. Ellen, thank you so much for being with us. You have a great night.
Thank you very much.
And we look forward to having you again with us one day. You're really just, like I said, a wealth of information. Get the book, guys. It's an unbelievable book. It's very informative. I think people need to read this book. I think it will help us to at least sort out and figure out what the heck is going on in our economy these days. Goodbye, folks, and see you next week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief fountain fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest. to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land.